Chapter 23. Tulip Mansion was situated just outside of New York, in Rye County. The building itself sat on top of one of the small mountains that made up the majority of the rugged region, where it was surrounded by pine forests that swarmed over the adjacent hills. Mingling in among the tall trees were huge rhododendron bushes that enjoyed the stony soil, producing the most exquisite carpet of color when they were in flower. People who had homes there tended to stay for many lives and centuries. Rye's proximity to the city made it an excellent area to live for those who could afford the land prices. It wasn't as chic as the Hamptons, but it was very convenient. Miles Foran had thought so when he began his estate at the start of the 21st century, an internet billionaire whose share stock had achieved a near ballistic trajectory upward. With the Tulip Mansion, it was his goal to build the first true American stately home of the new millennium. Not for him the standard timber frame mansion clad in brick and stone. Mock was not in the vocabulary when the architects were summoned. His ornate stone walls had cores of concrete and steel that would last for centuries. Craftsmen were flown in from all over the world. Master carpenters and stonemasons chipped and chiseled away, crafting a work of art you could live in. Aristocratic designers were contracted to produce a modern classic interior that would make the palaces of oil potentates seem cheap and tacky by comparison. The grounds were shaped and landscaped into gardens that would rival those of Versailles. The decade-long project was well underway when Jeff Baker released into the global market his new Crystal Memory, the pinnacle of electronic data storage, eliminating all other competing systems, obliterating copyright, and revolutionizing the internet into the data sphere. Gravity suddenly took a very firm grip on Foran's stock trajectory, which not even filing Chapter 11 bankruptcy could protect him from. Several years later, the creditor banks were quietly grateful when Gore Benelli made them a small offer for the estate and its half-completed folly. Work was resumed. The central stamen tower was completed, topped out with its gold anther crown. The four wings laid out around it were the flower's petals, stretched oval shapes that were given curving scarlet and black roofs, whose design was stolen directly from the Sydney Opera House. Inside were reception rooms, a ballroom, a grand banqueting hall, 50 guest bedrooms, a library, swimming pools, solariums, games rooms, and cavernous underground garages, stocked with a range of vehicles that any motor history museum would kill to obtain. All in all, it was excessive to the point of vulgar, but Justine spent more time at the Tulip Mansion than she did at any other family residence. If anywhere was home for her, it was here, and now she was having to host Muriel's engagement party in the gardens at a time that was monstrously inappropriate. But the party had been planned months in advance. The negotiations between lawyer teams representing the Benellis and the Constantines had been completed. Their union had to be examined for share block shifts between the two families. Not that core blocks would change. This couple's relatively junior status meant they'd only be awarded secondary shares, a few small companies spun off, a virtual finance house, real estate in Phase 3 space. Though given this was a direct-line merger, the lawyers had also allowed for the possibility of closer fusion for the children in a couple of centuries. It was an interesting dynamic, which had taken a long time to be cleared. A tearful Muriel had bravely volunteered to postpone the party. After all, Thompson was her ancestor. Justine had smiled at the bewildered First Life girl and said, "Not at all. Thompson would want you to carry on." So at midday she stood under a rose-covered gazebo receiving guests, who rolled up in modern limousines or fabulous antique cars. She paid no attention to the vehicles. Her interest in one-upmanship among society had been exhausted centuries ago, although she had to own up to a certain awareness when it came to who was wearing what. Costumes were supposed to be themed from around the 1950s, and the pavilion set up across the garden's high lawn reflected that. Waiters in period uniform served cocktails from the era. For herself, Justine had chosen a formal sea-green evening dress with a mermaid-tail skirt. She drew the line at heels on the grass, though. A 56 Oldsmobile pulled up, and Estella slowly got out of the back. "What on earth happened to you?" Justine asked as her friend limped over to the gazebo. Estella was wearing a scarlet dress with white polka dots and pink winged sunglasses. Instead of shoes, she was wearing a pair of electro-muscle support boots. Estella gave her a brief kiss on both cheeks. "I'm so sorry to spoil the look of the thing, darling. But I went and sprained both ankles. It was hideously painful, I kid you not."
"How did you do that?"
"So silly. I was dancing on the coffee table at a party. When I jumped off, I landed badly. I don't understand it, darling. I've danced on that table 100 times, and nothing like this has ever happened before."
Justine didn't scold. It would have been far too parental.
"I never get asked to parties like that anymore."
"I should think not, Senator. You have a reputation to consider now."
"Oh, thanks. It's people like you I need support from."
"I know, darling."
Estella laid her hand on Justine's arm.
"How's it going? Is it really awful?"
"Thompson had an excellent staff, team. I just vote the way they tell me to. I haven't started doing deals myself yet. It's just a temporary appointment, after all. Though the senators did give me a unanimous vote to carry on his representation. Even his opponents endorsed me. I think they were all shocked or running scared. Nobody's ever killed a senator before. This was supposed to send a message to the killer that you can't stop politicians like this. So all I'm doing is basically holding the fort till he gets out of the clinic."
"Be brave.
You know me."
She gave a brittle laugh. "Do they know who did it yet?"
"No. Nor why. It's all so stupid. Who kills people in this day and age? We're not in the barbarian era anymore."
Estella plucked at her dress.
"We are this afternoon."
"Yeah.
Are you staying for the play tonight?" "It's a Midsummer Night's Dream. The Tullthorpe actors are supposed to be very good, and the gardeners have built an open-air stage in front of the Lower Beech Woods."
"I'm not walking off anywhere, darling. A stiff drink and a decent-looking first-life waiter is what I need."
"Good. I'll talk to you later, yeah?"
"Sure thing.
Now, is this Muriel?"
"Of course."
Justine introduced her friend to the girl and her fiancé, who were waiting on the other side of the gazebo. Muriel was wearing a copy of the white dress Marilyn Monroe had on in the 7-Year Itch, and carried it off well, Justine had to admit. She did have a fabulous figure, and with it such a wondrously sunny disposition that Justine had to acknowledge how old and jaded she truly was nowadays, despite wearing a body of young flesh. Young Starrel Constantine was so obviously smitten as he stood at her side, the two of them holding hands the entire time. Simply being around them was wearying to Justine. For ages she'd been swept along by Muriel's ingenue enthusiasm for her fiancé, and the party, and the marriage, and their future life together, and the many children she wanted to produce, with natural pregnancies, for God's sake, for her handsome beau. It had been a marvelous distraction helping the girl plan everything. Muriel had been living at the Tulip Mansion for the 5 months since she finished Yale. Even the Primes and the Navy were just parallel subjects. Then some lunatic had killed Thompson. Why? And now she had to be tough and resolute, the way everyone expected a senior Benelli to behave, when all she really wanted to do was put her arms around her little brother and cuddle him, like she used to do, when she was 5 years old and he was a baby.
"Are you all right, Grandy?"
Muriel asked. To her horror, Justine realized her eyes were moistening.
"Not now, God damn it."
"Coping," she said staunchly. "I just remember him every now and then. That's all." Muriel put her arms around Justine. It was such a childlike gesture, spontaneous and genuine, that Justine was in danger of sobbing out loud.
"It's all right, Grandy,"
Muriel said softly.
"He'll be back soon."
"Yes.
Thank you."
Justine nodded appreciatively, wanting to escape from Muriel's big, concerned smile.
"Sorry, I'm ruining this for you."
"We're family, Grandy.
That means accepting the rough with the smooth, and standing together through all of it."
Justine picked at the girl's shoulder straps, adjusting them.
"Better or worse, eh?"
"I've got the better part of it right now." She glanced across at Starrel, who gave an understanding smile.
"You know, he's very good in bed,"
Muriel said in a low, confidential voice.
Yes, dear, you told me.
I don't mind if you want to spend a few nights with him, Grandy, before we get married.
Justine started giggling. She couldn't help it. Muriel was absolutely serious. How wonderful to be that young.
That's all right, dear.
You enjoy him. He really is a great catch. Anyone can see that. Take him upstairs every night and simply ruin him for any other girl.
I do my best to be bad,
Muriel said demurely.
Good.
Us Brunelli girls have reputations to maintain, you know. I'm depending on you to uphold the family honor. If they can still walk in the morning, we've not been bad enough. Muriel was giggling now. Staral directed a faintly suspicious and worried look at the little female conspiracy meeting.
Oh, Lordy,
Justine murmured. She'd just seen a stretched Skoda pull up.
Look who's here, and Joy,
she's brought her new whore with her. The two Benelli straightened up and put on their false smiles as Alessandra Baron walked up to them.
My dear Senator, I'm so sorry about your brother,
Alessandra said. Thompson was always such a delight to have on my show. A decent politician, I always called him. One of the lads. Justine gave the celebrity a pretentious, exaggerated air kiss.
Why, thank you.
He thought the same about you. As soon as his new body is conscious, tell him I was asking after him, and I'd love to have him back on my show.
I'll tell him. Thank you.
I want to introduce my newest and best affiliate reporter, Alessandra gushed. This is Melanie Rescorai.
Justine smiled as she shook hands with the young woman. She was a first lifer, about the same age as Muriel, but that was about the only similarity. This one was a raw street fighter, Justine saw, dangerously ambitious. Strange that Alessandra hadn't recognized that. But then perhaps she was off guard when looking into a mirror.
An honor, Senator, Melanie said. You have a lovely home here.
Thank you.
I've accessed your reports several times.
You seem to be making quite a name for yourself, especially on Elan. Those people were awful, opposing the Navy like that. The Commonwealth should know what they were doing.
I'm sure they should.
Now, Melanie, this is a party, Alessandra chided, and this has to be the blushing bride.
She took both of Muriel's hands.
Congratulations on your engagement, my dear.
You look wonderful. You're putting the rest of us to shame in that dress.
Quite right, too.
Why, thank you,
Muriel said sweetly.
Yes, congratulations, Melanie said. You're very lucky.
It almost sounded as though she meant it. Justine waited until the reporters had said hello to Staral and left the gazebo.
Remind me, why did we invite her?
It's a society wedding, Grandy. There are rules.
Oh, yes. I knew there was a good reason.
Do you think Gore will come? Staral's family has all shown.
Don't worry, he'll be here.
He knows what I'd do to him if he doesn't show.
Gore Benelli did turn up in his huge Zill limousine, although it wasn't until well after 5 o'clock. Justine broke off from the group of Halgarths she was talking to and went to greet her father. He was wearing a perfectly cut tuxedo, though not even that could help make his gold face and hand seem human. There was a woman with him that Justine didn't recognize at first. Very attractive, with a young face that had some oriental features, black hair tied back neatly. She was in a modern business suit, which was annoying. The invitations had been most specific.
Don't scowl, Gore said. Paula is here as my guest.
Delighted,
Justine said. Then she recognized the woman without even having to reference her e-butler.
Investigator, I've followed a lot of your cases.
Ex-investigator, Paula said. I was dismissed.
Which is why we're here, Gore said.
Justine didn't know why, but she had hoped that just for once this party wouldn't be cover for business and deals, that people might actually kick back and enjoy themselves. She sighed.
We'll use your study.
Like Justine, Gore treated the Tulip Mansion as his main base of operations. Not only was it perfectly physically secure, it had a cybersphere nexus larger than that of most corporate headquarters. The principal access was his study. Like Gore himself, it represented the pinnacle of interface technology. When linked together, they were synergistic.
Technicians from family-owned laboratories were always rebuilding it and then modifying systems, incorporating advances that wouldn't appear on the commercial market for years. Visually, it was difficult to see its true size. There were no reference points. The surface was a hard, pearl-white plastic that glowed from within. Little points of light sparkled away inside it, traveling slowly. Justine always had the impression of being inside some giant photonic processor. Once the door was closed, the three of them looked like they'd been superimposed inside a blank hologram projection. Curved chairs morphed up out of the floor, shaped like sculpted beanbags. Their internal glow changed from neutral to a faint copper, allowing them to be seen. After they'd all sat down, the tinge faded away. "I'm appointing Paula to the Senate Security Service," Gore announced. "She's to have department head status. You'll have to clear it."
"I see," Justine said peacefully. "And why is that?"
"Your brother's murder was committed by someone connected with the case I've been working on," Paula said.
"Johansson, you mean? I don't wish to be critical, particularly now. But you've been working on that case for quite a while now. That was the reason Raphael Columbia dismissed you, wasn't it? Lack of results."
"Columbia is a fucking asshole," Gore said. "We're going to have to watch him. That little shit won't be satisfied until he's crowned emperor."
Justine gave Paula a level gaze.
"He does have a point, though. You had nearly 140 years.
"The case involved a lot more than the great wormhole heist," Paula said. "I always knew Johansson was being protected by someone inside the Senate or the executive. Your brother confirmed that for me. Then he was murdered."
"Who murdered him?"
"I don't know. The assassin is an unknown operative. Nor do I know who he works for, although I have my suspicions."
"Who?"
Justine growled.
"The Starflyer."
After the anticipation, Justine fell back into the chair, disgusted.
"For God's sake!"
"I believe it," Gore said.
"Dad, you cannot be serious."
"We were played by an absolute expert.
I knew there was something suspicious about putting the Navy package together. It was too fucking easy. Someone else had been laying the political groundwork."
"Garbage. Nobody knew we'd have a need for a Navy until the Second Chance returned.
I'm still not entirely convinced myself. We only got involved for the contracts."
"Damn right. That's our motivation. Naked greed, the fear of being poor, unprotected, not in control.
It knows us very well, doesn't it?"
"No."
Justine shook her head.
"What did my brother tell you?"
she asked Paula.
"I have been asking for an inspection on all goods shipped to far away for decades. If I could nail down the arms shipments, it would help me solve the Johansson case permanently. Your brother found out that Nigel Sheldon has been preventing it."
That's...
Justine turned to her father, appealing.
"You can't believe this."
"Why can't the Starflyer exist?" he asked her in return.
"The Institute on Far Away would have found it."
"According to Johansson, they did," Paula said. "He was the director, remember?"
"I know he was," she said wryly. Her thoughts had slipped back to the sunny glade in the forest where her hyperglider had landed.
Dear sweet Casimir's utter conviction in his mad cause.
"All right. Just assume this alien does exist, and Nigel Sheldon is working for it, or has been taken over by it, or whatever. How does that get Thompson murdered?"
"Because he finally pushed through the inspection," Paula said. "I only just realized the relevance myself last night. But keeping the faraway route open and free of any official interference has been something of a devil's alliance for the two factions. The Guardians want it so they can smuggle their weapons back there. The Starflyer wants it so that it can return."
"Return?
You mean to its ship?"
Justine asked.
"Yes, that's what the Guardians believe. That when it has ruined the Commonwealth, it will go back."
"Why?"
"The ship's a wreck. The planet is half dead."
"I know. I've been there."
She caught it. Shift of the eyes. Change of breathing pattern. A dozen other indiscreet indicators. Most people wouldn't have noticed, but Justine had been a player for 3.5 centuries, dealing with masterclass politicians and corporate lords.
To her, body language was a million-watt telepathic broadcast. And that last statement had just turned her into Paula Mayo's newest suspect.
Nobody understands its motivation, Paula said, except perhaps Johansson. And I wouldn't consider him reliable, even if he turns out to be right in the end. All we have to go on is the Guardian's propaganda. They claim it intends to return.
And you think that's what got my brother murdered?
He put an obstacle in its way.
Justine gave her father a long look, seeing a curved image of herself in his smooth golden mirror face. His silence made it obvious whose side he was on here. So how does appointing you to Senate security help find the murderer?
It will give me access to all Navy intelligence information on the case. I can see what they're doing, but they won't know I'm looking over their shoulder. That way I can stay one step ahead of them.
Just wait on here, Justine protested. Who are you trying to catch?
Ultimately the Starflyer. But to do that I will need Johansson. He is the only expert we have on it.
Paula glanced at Gore. Unless I go too far away. Out of the question, Gore shot back. I told you. You're too valuable to go off chasing around an unknown countryside full of guerrillas. Besides, you're not geared up for that kind of operation. Your public profile is too high. We need to keep you out of sight behind a desk. Now that I know what's actually been going on around here, we can send some covert agents from our family security teams to take a damn close look at both factions on Far Away. I want to know exactly what the fuck's been happening out there.
Very well, Justine said. I'll have Thompson's office arrange your clearance.
You should be able to start tomorrow.
It wasn't that she agreed with her father.
She simply couldn't see any other way to proceed for now.
Morton would have liked the party, Melanie knew. It was full of players that were in a league far above any he'd moved among on Oak Tier. Even that airhead Muriel had more money in her trust fund than Morton's beloved Gansu Construction was capitalized at. He would have been dealing from the moment they arrived until the catering bot started clearing up in the wee small hours. She was entranced by the Tulip Mansion. That much wealth and antiquity and style in one package was overwhelming to a girl from Dark Lake City. Growing up in such an environment would leave anyone with real confidence and poise. A childhood spent here must have been magnificent. She could see groups of children running about across the grounds, carefree and happy as they played simple, timeless games of catch and chase. Her blank smile concealed her envy. Looking around at the beautiful people as they chatted in groups on the lawn, she still felt she was living in someone else's TSI biog drama. She knew how to move with them, how to laugh at their inane jokes, when to smile knowingly as they gossiped, the names of wines and food, how to pronounce them correctly. Art was still difficult for her. The grand families and intersolar dynasties seemed to have an encyclopedic history of art available at a genetic level, but her e-butler kept the files on quick recall.
Ah, there's Campbell Sheldon, Alessandra said.
Her hand waved discreetly toward one of the marquees.
See him.
Melanie turned slowly, scanning the group standing around the marquee, framed by one of the giant flower arrangements. Her virtual vision displayed the file picture of Sheldon, and she matched it with the real man.
Got him.
Campbell is your fuck tonight.
He was their family's chief negotiator when the Navy was put together. So he'll have access to the stats. How are the construction schedules holding up? What's the true budget overspend? You know what we need.
Melanie said nothing. Alessandra gave her a disapproving look.
You're not going soft on me, are you?
There are about 1 billion other girls who would like to take your place.
I know. But he's a Sheldon. He's not going to give me figures on stuff like that.
He's not dumb.
Of course not.
He knows who you are and why you're sucking his dick.
That's the point. He won't give you figures, but he'll show us the direction to take. They're all at war with each other, young Melanie.
All struggling for dominance, and information is their weapon. If one of his rivals is screwing up, you'll be told.
Melanie gave the group a second look. It was 6:30. She'd had too many cocktails and too many vacuous conversations, where every sentence began and ended with, darling.
There were lights on inside the marquees, and paths across the lawns were glowing blue as if they were phosphorescent streams.
Why do they have marquees?
This place must have force fields. They'll turn them on if it starts raining.
I'm sure they will, Alessandra said in an annoyed tone. So if we're not going to get wet, why put up marquees?
Go ask Campbell. The Sheldons are all technology bores. I'm sure he'll love explaining it all to you.
Do you like anybody?
I like you. Alessandra leaned forward and gave her a firm kiss. Melanie was slow to respond.
Don't be such a bitch, Alessandra complained.
Melanie glared at her through the alcohol buzz. Then she blinked, peering across the darkling grounds.
That's Mayo. Paula Mayo?
Alessandra couldn't keep the twang of interest out of her voice.
Yes. Curious.
She kept facing Melanie.
Who's she with?
A nobody. Security man. Melanie was quite pleased, she could tell.
So she's dealing with the Bernellis.
Let me have it. You've got to stop obsessing on the woman. It's a good story and you know it. I'll fuck whoever you want, but give it to me.
That's my Melanie.
All right. I can spare you for a couple of days. If you can find out what she's doing for the Bernellis, I'll be impressed. But if not, I want you back on Elan in 48 hours.
Thank you.
Melanie kissed her. Properly, this time.
All right,
Alessandra said eventually, chortling happily. Campbell!
Remember? Now go.
Melanie dropped her cocktail glass into the rose bushes, shook her tousled hair back, pushed her tits out, and started walking toward her target. The engagement party was going well after all. Justine surveyed the guests as they drifted in for the evening buffet. A 20-piece band had set up in front of the big fountain pool to play merry 1950s tunes. She could hear a lot of laughter amid the drone of conversation. Thick flower scents drifted on the fresh night air. Overhead, the constellations burned brightly. Down toward the beech wood, the Tolthorpe troupe was running through their final rehearsal with the stage techs. Her mood had lifted considerably since her father and the Mayo woman had left. She supposed she couldn't have been surprised at her father accepting conspiracy theories in his desperation to catch the murderer. It was just that he was always the ruthlessly logical one. Thompson's murder must have shaken him up a lot more than he was admitting to. In the morning, she would take the time and talk to him properly about the whole situation. In the meantime, however, there was still time to have a lot of fun. And there were several men on the guest list she'd be happy to spend the night with. When she started searching around, she saw Campbell Sheldon. He had a blissful smile on his face as he chatted away to Melanie Rescorai. The girl had obviously decided he was going to take her to bed. Justine rolled her eyes at the folly of the male psyche. Oh well, he was a big boy. He'd probably survive the experience. Ramon D.B. was over by the marquee, giving the food a long, guilty look. She smiled warmly. He'd been a tower of strength for her at Senate Hall, helping her through long, difficult days. He was due for rejuvenation in another year. She'd miss him in the meantime, although when he was 20 he was so handsome. She looked for Estella, who would be good, uncomplicated company.
You left this behind, ma'am.
Justine turned to face the young waiter who was holding out a silver tray. There were no glasses on it, only a tatty, faded old sun hat.
I don't think I...
She stopped, stared at the sun hat. Suddenly some strange force was squeezing her throat, making it difficult to breathe. That same force that was making incredulous tears sting her eyes as she looked up into the waiter's face.
Oh, my God. Casimir.
Her legs almost gave out, but she still managed to fling her arms around him. He was bigger, older, with much broader shoulders. A dark, handsome face with jet-black hair flopping down over his forehead, and he was as ecstatic as she.
Every night I have dreamed of you, my angel, he whispered into her ear as his hand stroked her hair.
She clutched his back, almost tearing the waiter jacket fabric.
Every night.
He was trembling now. Justine tightened her grip on him.
Every night I wanted you to be happy.
I wanted you to love your beautiful life. Yet even wishing you all that, I wished I could see you for just 1 minute more. Shush!
She slid a finger down over his lips, then kissed him. Tenderly at first, not believing this could be real, then demanding, passionate, shaking in his embrace. He pulled back, staring intently into her eyes. His smile of wonder was as bright as ever, brighter than her memory.
It is you,
she said exultantly.
Really, you?
I had to come, my angel. Different worlds or different galaxies, I couldn't be apart from you. I had to find a way. Forgive me.
Oh, Casimir.
She knew she was going to cry and didn't care. Her gorgeous, romantic, foolish lover had pursued her across the stars. Come with me, she said softly, and pulled him imploringly, longingly, toward the Tulip Mansion. In the full dark of midnight, hologram projectors cloaked the open-air stage in broad strokes of primary color. Dry ice flooded spookily through the beech trees. Cleverly positioned force fields allowed Puck and the fairies to fly gracefully through the air. Soliloquies were declaimed with bravado and majesty, to be greeted with enthusiastic applause from the audience. Justine neither heard nor saw any of the Tolthorpe's troop's finest hour. In the darkness and peace of her bedroom, her own body was performing the most erotic, sensual acts she could physically achieve. She had forgotten what it was like to be adored so completely, so unselfishly. He was so much more responsive now, matching the pleasure she gave with ease, willing and eager to satisfy her. They could be gentle and slow with each other, moving in tender rhythm, or fierce, almost fighting to bring themselves to climax. It didn't matter, both kinds of lovemaking were right for them. Time after time amid the silky shadows, she watched his enraptured, straining features soften into a smile of unbearable joy, only to lose herself in the same delirium. For once, there were no chemicals or programs to help. This was real. When the dawn cast its bland gray illumination into the bedroom, she smiled at their bodies, still wrapped together, sweat mingling on their skin, faces inches apart, sharing perfect, secret contentment.
I love you, he said fearfully.
I love you. I won't let you go again. She smiled in admiration at the conviction in his voice. What are you doing here on Earth? She knew the answer she wanted, that it was for her and her alone. There was a chance that I could see you. How could I ever let that go by? My wonderful love. She put a finger on his thorax and slowly drew a line down his sternum, playfully following the ridges of hard muscle. His body was fabulous. How long would it have taken a boy born into low grav to build himself up to handle standard gravity? The effort he'd made, the determination. She was rather glad she'd kept up her own aerobic classes and maintenance diet, still slim and trim. It will be difficult to get away to see you, but I will manage it. Her finger stopped just as it reached his navel. Already she knew this was going to be bad news. Get away from whom? The Guardians, of course. I'm here on a mission. Oh, Christ. She pushed at him, slithering herself over the sheets until she was an arm's length away, and stared at him in dismay. Already his youthful, sympathetic face had produced a puzzled expression.
A mission? She croaked. You're here on some kind of Guardian mission?
Yes. Oh, Casimir, no. No, you can't do that kind of thing here. This isn't far away. You have to stop.
I cannot stop. This is our time.
This is when the planet will have its revenge on the Starflyer. I'm a part of that, Justine. Bradley Johansson chose me. She wanted to put her head in her hands, or maybe belt some sense into him. Casimir, listen to me. We have a navy now, which has a branch dedicated to stopping Johansson. Hundreds of officers are working on the case. They will catch you. They will. His kindly smile was one that told her she simply didn't understand. They won't. We're perfectly safe.
Casimir, this is not a game.
I am the one who has always known that. And now you have become a victim of the Starflyer, too. I wept when I heard its creature had murdered your brother. How cruel that fate.
that of all the people in the Commonwealth, it hurt the only person I love.
No.
God, no, this isn't happening. Casimir, please, there is no Starflyer. My brother was killed by his rivals. It's ugly and brutal and shocking, and it's never happened in Commonwealth politics before. But it is not the fault of a secret alien. Politicians are its creatures, too. They are the easiest of all humans to corrupt.
Listen to yourself. You're just repeating student slogans.
Johansson is an evil old man who's using you, and all the other clans back on far away.
Justine, I'm sorry. But it is you who cannot see the truth in this. I can't believe we're having this argument. You have to stop, Casimir. Just walk away.
I'll clear any problem with your involvement. God knows, you've been indoctrinated since birth.
Nobody will blame you.
How could you ask me that? He demanded, shocked and hurt. I had hoped you would help us. The planet's revenge can be your revenge as well, if you let it. You can make sure the Starflyer is defeated.
What? What are you talking about?
Get the cargo inspections lifted.
What?
He couldn't have appalled her more if he'd slapped her.
Is that why you came?
She asked.
No,
he protested. I risked everything to come to you. Everything. I love you, Justine. I am fighting to save your world. She leaned forward and grasped his hands, desperately conscious of how young and idealistic he was. How much he had to prove himself.
I don't want you to. Not like this.
Casimir, it is a far braver and nobler thing to admit you are wrong. I know, I've had to do it many times. Please, just consider leaving the Guardians to manage without you for a while.
You and I can talk this through.
You can browbeat me, you mean. That's not what I mean at all. I just want you to learn that there are other viewpoints than the Guardians.
I cannot desert my comrades. You should not ask me this. I watched my best friend die in front of me. I have lost many others. Now you say it was for nothing.
What are you going to do?
What are you going to do?
He countered. Will you try and stop me returning to my comrades?
I will not let your security people interrogate me.
Calm down, she said hurriedly. Nobody's going to stop you leaving. I don't want you to leave. But that's the only chain around you, how much I love you and don't want to see you harmed.
I have been through many battles. I have no fear of my enemy.
God! She growled through clenched teeth.
Men!
He gave her a twitchy smile and rolled off the bed. Where are you going? You're not going now.
I have to.
He shrugged, almost blushing. I hadn't expected to spend the night. She felt her own cheeks coloring at that.
I want you to spend every night here, Casimir.
I want every night to be like last night. I don't do this anymore.
Damn it, I thought...
I didn't think I could care for someone like this. Not anymore. But you... When this is over, when nothing lies between us, I will be yours for as long as you'll have me.
Damn it!
Her eyes were watering.
Don't cry.
I won't have my beautiful angel cry for me. I'm not worth it.
You are. You are so worth it.
You have no idea. He finished dressing, then held her for a long moment. I will come back for you, he promised gravely. I swear it. She nodded, too exhausted emotionally and physically to do anything else. After a while, with fresh tears running freely down her cheeks, she placed a call to Alec Hogan at his Paris office. It started raining an hour before dawn, cold drops splattering down on the cobbles to form grubby rivulets racing down the gutters. Tired, miserable, and hungry, Melanie stood in a doorway three down from Paula Mayo's Paris apartment as the sun rose, exposing the narrow street to a grey shading that belonged to the Middle Ages. The time-bowed wooden lintel above her was dripping steadily on her head, wrecking her expensive hairstyle. There had been no time for her to prepare properly. She knew Alessandra wouldn't allow her a second longer than the 2 days unless she got a real story. So her jacket collar was turned up in a grim attempt to keep some of the cold out, because the 1950s party dress she wore under it was certainly no good for that.
Both feet were soaking inside her hand-stitched Italian leather shoes, which were now ruined. The early morning monotony was occasionally broken by a civic GP bot rolling past her. By 6 o'clock, people had started using the street. She received a few curious glances. Their eyes soon slid away, deciding she was some hooker waiting for her pimp or pusher after a bad night. "Close," she told their backs as they hurried away. At 7:30, Paula Meyer walked out onto the street. She wore a long raincoat, unbuttoned to show her usual business suit. Her feet were protected by calf-high boose-hide boots, and she switched on a ply-plastic umbrella stick that flowed out into a wide black mushroom shape. Melanie waited until the woman had almost reached the end of the street and left the scant cover of the doorway. Her virtual vision displayed a simple map of the area. As she'd expected, Mayo was walking to the nearest metro station. She kept 20 meters or so behind her, trying not to be too obvious. The wider streets had some traffic and pedestrians, making cover easier. Headlights cast bright reflection ribbons on the black tarmac, while their tires produced a thin, dirty spray. The smell of fresh-baked bread emerged from patisseries that were opening their doors. Melanie's stomach growled from the temptation. Ahead of her, Mayo turned a corner. Melanie hurried forward. When she turned the corner, the metro station sign gleamed brightly 50 meters ahead. Mayo had vanished. "Where?" Melanie scanned around. The woman hadn't crossed to the other side of the road. None of the shops were open, so she couldn't have hidden inside anywhere. Damn it. In her mind, the plan had been perfect. Follow Mayo to wherever she was working. That would give a clue what she was working on for the Benellis, or even if it was the Benellis. Whatever, it would give her enough interesting questions for Alessandra to keep her on Mayo. "You would have made a dreadful field operative." "Huh?" Melanie spun around. Mayo was standing there, umbrella held straight, giving her a quizzical look. "It is illegal to run search programs through restricted city listings. Paul Cramley, the hacker you used to gain access, is old enough to know that. What are you going to do? Arrest us?" "No. He will have a formal charge filed against him. It will probably result in a fine and confiscation of his equipment." "Bitch. He broke the law. So have you. Being a reporter does not place you above the law, Ms. Rescorai. You have to obey the rules like every other citizen, however inconvenient that is to your so-called profession. I've never heard of this Paul Cramley. You can't prove anything." Mayo's stare hardened. "I don't have to. You are interfering with a government official, which is also an offense." "You're not. You got fi-" Melanie drew a deep breath. "I'm sorry. I was desperate for an interview with you. I don't give interviews. Everyone in your profession knows that. But you must be able to tell me if there are any suspects in the Benelli murder. Ask the Navy Intelligence Media Office for an update. They're not as good as you. If they do catch anyone, it'll be on the foundation you laid. I want the whole story." "I don't respond to flattery, either." "I'm not flattering you. I despise you. But I'm also a realist." A dark gray limousine drew up to the curb beside them. Its rear door opened. "You're wasting your time following me," Mayo said. Her ply-plastic umbrella flowed back into a simple fat stick. "Even if you were any good, you wouldn't find anything of interest where I'm going." "Where would I find something interesting?" "In truth, I'm not sure. You might try space. Deep space." She got into the back of the limousine, and its door closed. Melanie stood shivering in the rain, watching the plush vehicle's scarlet taillights merge into the Parisian traffic. "Is it true she never lies?" she asked the S.I. "It is true she never tells a direct lie, though she is capable of modifying the truth if it will forward her investigation." "Hell, deep space. Who knows about deep space?" There had been quite a celebration on High Angel last night. St. Asaph had returned from another flight, scouting 11 stars. Captain McLean Gilbert had reported that they hadn't encountered any prime wormhole activity.
Then along with Admiral Kime and Captain Oscar Monroe, he'd gone to watch the Dauntless disengage from her assembly platform. The warship was a distinct design change from the Second Chance and the earlier Scouts. She'd been built inside a single 300-meter-long hull, shaped like a stretched teardrop, with 8 blunt thermal radiator fins at the rear to complete the aerodynamic illusion. A crew of 30 were in command of a Mark IV hyperdrive, with a top speed of 1 light-year per hour, a 7-tier force field complemented with a locked molecule hull field. 50 missiles containing 15 independent 20G sub-warheads carrying 100-megaton charges capable of diverted energy functions, and 30 directed energy beam weapons. To supply power for the hyperdrive and the combat systems, 15 high-capacity Nyling desyncs had been installed. Charging them up to flight readiness was now beyond the generator capacity of Kerensk, which was already supplying power for the entire scout ship fleet. CST was laying in superconductor power lines from other planets to supply the anticipated fleet. The construction of new generators was providing a bull market for power bonds right across the Commonwealth, as entrepreneurs and existing utility companies bid to supply the Navy with gigawatts. Dauntless had disengaged right on time, small blue ion flames around her base pushing her slowly away from the open assembly platform. She'd curved around the High Angel, giving the people in the crystal domes a good view of her size and shape as she traversed Icalanis, before switching on her hyperdrive and vanishing in a burst of violet light. 3 completed, another 10 authorized, Wilson had said, as the big ship slipped over Babuyan Atoll. Defender is next out. She's yours if you want her, he told Oscar. Oh, I do. Yes, indeed, I truly do. Mac had laughed delightedly and congratulated his old friend. Then the pair of them had gone out and hit the town, such as it was in Babuyan Atoll, to toast the new command and the successful return. Oscar groaned miserably as the express shot into strong lemon-yellow sunlight, which shone through the first-class carriage windows. He reached for his sunglasses. So where did you two finish up last night? Antonia Clark asked from the seat opposite. I have no goddamn idea, Oscar grunted. There was a band there, I think. Maybe jazz. He picked up the cup of black coffee that the steward had just poured, looked at it, felt strange fluid start to churn in his stomach, and hurriedly put it down again. Antonia laughed. She'd already had to babysit him through the free-fall commuter flight from High Angel to the Kerensk wormhole station. Keeping his uniform clean under those circumstances had been tricky. Then there had been the complaints from their fellow passengers. Have you got your speech ready? She asked. Fuck off. You want another teefy hit? Look, just shut... Oh, God, yes, please. Grinning, she took out the packet of tubes and pressed one to his neck. There was a capacitor whine as the membrane pad on the end fast-tracked the drug into his bloodstream. That's your limit. No more for another 6 hours. He touched his fingertips delicately to his sweating forehead, testing to see if the pain was abating. They only print that to keep the lawyers quiet. You can take at least twice the dosage before anything bad happens. Ever the optimist. How do you feel? I think that one might actually be working. Good. The express went through another wormhole gateway, and the light became even brighter, a sharp blue-white. Antonia looked out of the window. We're here. New Costa Junction. Let's go. She stood up. Oscar gave the cup of coffee a last longing glance and decided against. A senior manager from the clinic was on the platform to greet them. He had a car for them, which slid smoothly onto Highway 37. 10-minute trip from here, the manager promised. We're between shifts, so the traffic is light. The Natsis Hotel was set back off the freeway, a 20-story X-shape, with 5 separate conference facilities. Over 1,000 media reporters were packed into the Bytham Auditorium, where the welcome back ceremony was to be performed. Both of the honored guests and all the VIPs walked en masse onto the stage, to considerable applause. Dudley Bowes, a lanky adolescent with a stock of ginger-blonde hair that refused styling, broke his sulk to grin around before eventually giving the thumbs up that had been his interview trademark.
Emmanuel Verbicki was a surprise to those who had accessed her file for background information. On the second chance, she'd been sober and professional to the point of dullness, a woman with rather bland features who didn't care about appearances. Today she was almost indistinguishable from a genuine first life 18-year-old. She'd chosen a strap-top purple dress with a short skirt to show off long legs that had been toned to perfection by the clinic's physiotherapists. Her dark hair, still shortish despite the accelerated growth phase of cloning, was arranged in neat curls that emphasized her youth. Her perpetual gleeful smile and very girlish giggle illustrated a rare case of someone being highly suited to the whole re-life procedure. It was Oscar who was scheduled to make the initial speech. He said hello to everybody. Then he had to perform the introductions, a stupid thing to do. After that was his own quick personal welcome to his former crewmates. He told a happy anecdote from the second chance to show what great friends they all were, while what he wanted to do was blurt out the story of how Bose had managed to screw up the shower filtration unit for his deck. After 5 minutes of torture, he sat down to polite applause and Antonia's mocking smile. Vice President Biklu was next, making the formal welcome back speech. A tall man whose features were sequenced and profiled to produce a bland handsomeness, along with Nordic white skin to contrast with Doi's African ethnicity. Oscar had to sit with a fixed smile as the VP made a very good speech, with plenty of easy jokes that had the media laughing and the other guests smiling appreciatively. He made Oscar look like the amateur warm-up act. When it was her turn, Emmanuel got up and gave the VP a sweet kiss on the cheek. She smiled at the big audience and said how nice it was to be back, how she was impressed by the progress the Navy had made, how she wanted to join up again as soon as she was old enough. Applause and a few whistles, and a big hello to all her friends, and thanks for all the support they'd shown while she was in re-life. She gave Dudley Bowes an encouraging wink as he went to the podium. "I've heard a lot this afternoon about how dedicated and friendly everyone was on the second chance," Dudley said. A hand came up automatically to play with his ear. "What a great ship. What a good job it did flying that mission." "I'm puzzled by that, because I haven't got a fucking clue which second chance they're talking about. It certainly isn't the one I flew on. The bastards I was crewing with left me there. Alone. My great so-called captain didn't even check to see if we were still alive. He was so desperate to save his own ass." His arm shot up, a rigid finger pointing at the ceiling. "I'm still out there, you know. Somehow. Some alien has kept me alive, or bits of me. So why am I here as well? What are you doing to me, you shits?" He stomped off the stage, leaving all the VIPs staring at each other in embarrassment. "Do something," Antonia said out of the corner of her mouth. "Why me?" Oscar mumbled back. Every reporter in the audience was looking at them expectantly, relaying the image through the unisphere. Many of them were smiling. It wasn't in sympathy. "You're the MC." "Oh, shit." Oscar walked slowly over to the center of the stage, where the main lights were focused. He cleared his throat. "Kids today, huh?" He'd never known a silence so deep, so unbroken. "Look. Okay, I'm sorry Dr. Bowes feels the way he does. Had we stayed at the watchtower, we would have died. It's that simple. The primes were firing nuclear missiles at us. You can't hang around philosophizing in circumstances like that." At the front of the audience, Alessandra Barron stood up. "Captain Monroe, the second chance had FTL capacity. The primes did not. So why didn't you circle back and make a final pass to see what had happened to your crewmates?" "Our primary mission was to report our findings back to the Commonwealth. Everybody on board knew that, Dr. Bowes included. We all accepted the risks." "But didn't your actions increase the risk factor in this case? One check wouldn't have endangered anybody on board. Didn't you care about your crewmates?" "They screwed up," Oscar snapped back, angry at the allegation. He remembered only too well what it had been like on board at the time. Now this moron, Prima Diva, was questioning their decisions from the safety of time and distance, or at least Bowes did.
He wasn't properly trained to join the exploratory team. Nobody wanted the old idiot on board in the first place.
This time the silence that opened up was even deeper. Then 1,000 questions were shouted at once. Antonia's arm came protectively around Oscar's shoulder. "Thank you for your time, ladies and gentlemen," she bawled through the PA at full volume. "Drinks and canapés are now served in the lounge. Enjoy." She physically hauled Oscar off the stage in something approaching a wrestling lock. He got one glimpse of Baron's diabolically victorious smile before they reached the wings. Vice President Biklu's white skin had turned puce.
"Why didn't anyone brief me this was hostile?"
He was shouting at his aides. He caught sight of Oscar.
"Yo, what the hell was that?"
"Later," Antonia sang out cheerfully, still pushing Oscar along. They reached one of the hotel's service corridors and came to a halt. Oscar put a hand on his forehead. It was hot and sweating. His headache was back again big time. When he pulled his hand away, he half expected the dampness he'd felt to be blood.
"Oh my God, did I really say that?"
"Yep," Antonia said. She sounded inordinately pleased. "And it was about time somebody did."
"Oh, God. I think I just blew the Defender captaincy."
"Don't be so stupid. Come on. This is a hotel. There's got to be a bar somewhere. I'll buy you a hair of the dog. You need it."
Dudley ignored everyone. The government officials, hotel staff, even the nurse from the clinic. As soon as he left the stage, he ran, blundering through the maze of corridors, until he came to a big, deserted kitchen. Only then did he stop and draw a very shaky breath. He pressed his head on the side of a big refrigeration cabinet, enjoying the feel of the cool stainless steel surface against his skin. His heart was pounding and his hands shaking. It wasn't entirely due to running.
"I did it," he whispered and smiled to himself,
told them what he thought in front of every reporter who counted in the Commonwealth, and the Vice President. Just the thought sent another tremble along his limbs. Somebody started clapping in a slow, almost derisory fashion. Dudley straightened up. He almost expected it to be the Vice President's bodyguards, coming at him with ion pistols blazing. Instead, it was a beautiful young girl with wavy golden hair that came down over her shoulders. She was wearing a scoop-neck top of some rust-pink gauze with a silver leaf pattern, and a pair of clinging faded blue jeans that had a small silver M on one of the belt loops. There was a lopsided approving grin on her lips as she approached. She had very white teeth, Dudley noticed. That and the top was translucent. His face began to redden.
"That took a lot of courage to say what you did," she said.
"I respect that."
"Thank you."
It didn't quite come out as a stutter. He knew he was staring, and just couldn't help himself. She was more than attractive. Her body had this healthiness about it that was intoxicating. His own body was getting uncontrollably hot. He hadn't managed to have sex yet, not in this body. Just a whole load of lonely nights spent masturbating since he'd been physically able, which wasn't long. Memories of women he'd been with kept flashing up through his mind, as well as all the ones he'd never had the guts to ask. His old self would never ask a girl like this for a date, he knew.
"It must have been awful for you to realize what they did," she said, "coming to terms with how they betrayed you."
"Yes. Yes, it was.
Without you, none of this would be possible. None of the starships they've built. The important new positions your ex-shipmates have carved for themselves. I can't believe they did it. They left us there to die."
Even now, after all the months thinking about it, trying to come to terms with the flight, his bitterness and shock were as strong now as the day he'd found out.
"They didn't care about me. Not one of them."
"I know," she said softly. "A lot of us know." Her smile was enchanting.
"I remember when you discovered the envelopment. I used to access reports of you when I was at school. I used to think I wanted to be an astronomer because of you."
He twitched his shoulders around awkwardly. Her closeness was dangerous. He could feel his erection growing because of that. He was frightened she'd see it. He wanted to see her naked. He wanted them to be screwing like demons on overdrive.
Did you? Are you one? An astronomer?
No,
I'm not the intellectual type, I'm afraid. I chose a sports curriculum in the end. I was on a diving team.
Oh, you know, I can hardly believe I'm talking to my old idol.
I'm nobody's idol. I'm not even sure I'm me. The base of his fist knocked against the refrigeration cabinet again and again. Even talking to her couldn't divert his thoughts for long. You know, the real Dudley Bowes is still out there, still looking at alien stars, but from a much closer viewpoint these days. His laugh was high-pitched, almost out of control. Her hand caught his fist and held on, preventing him from moving it.
I'm Melanie. Pleased to meet you.
All he could feel was her fingers gripping his wrist, her strength and warmth. She had dabbed on the faintest of perfumes. He breathed in deeply, knowing a scent that was so very different to the filtered, conditioned air of the clinic, a human scent.
I have a rented car outside, and I also have a room in this hotel.
Dudley found it almost painful to say anything.
Yes. So, I can either drive you to the nearest silent world, or we can go upstairs. Now. Right now.
The hotel room was as mass-produced and indistinguishable as any other Augusta product, a long L-shape with a balcony at one end and the marbled bathroom at the other. The big double bed was on a raised level, with curtains that could close it off from the rest of the room. It was dark outside when Oscar finally opened the door and stumbled in. He'd spent 2 hours in the small fifth-floor, residence-only cocktail lounge with Antonia before the reporters tracked them down. That had been the end of that party. He left the lights off and went over to the kitchen alcove. There was enough illumination coming in through the wide glass patio doors to see the beer bottles in the fridge. He chose one and popped the top. Antonia had been right. A hair of the dog always worked a lot better than a teefy hit. His hangover had completely vanished now. The hotel menu was on the counter. He picked it up as he went out and stood on the narrow balcony. There had been a formal banquet planned for this evening to finish the whole welcome back event, which was why he had the room. But the meal had been cancelled. If he was going to get anything to eat, it would have to be room service. Outside, New Costa gleamed brightly under the night sky, as if it were an amplifying mirror for the constellations above. Inland, to the north, the horizon was glowing a deep, hued amber, where the steel smelters were stretched out amid the Colray Hills. A genuine false dawn. The corona was actually brighter than the sky of a world with an orange dwarf star he remembered exploring 8, 9 years ago. Highways were slow-moving pyrotechnic rivers, winding through the sparkling grids in perpetual motion. Narrow strips of darkness cut across the city. Rail tracks where long, glimmering trains rolled endlessly between yards and stations and factories. Oscar smiled passively at the industrial megalopolis, overwhelmed, as always, by its sheer size and energy. The Alliope wind was strong tonight, sending warm, dry air to scour the highways and avenues. He took a sip on the beer. Somewhere out there in the jeweled grid of lights were the factories where CST built its hyperdrives. There had been rumors around Base 1 of the latest variants, faster than the Mark 4s. A lot faster. Now that would be some starship.
That was quite a performance this afternoon.
Oscar jumped at the voice. The beer bottle slipped out of his fingers, falling soundlessly toward the dark parking lot 15 stories below.
Shit!
When he lurched back into the room, there was a man sitting on the sofa. Oscar had never seen him when he came in.
Some people never change, the man said. You were always a little too fond of the old booze.
Who? What? There was a chuckle, and the man turned a table light on. Oscar peered at the intruder. He was quite old, probably early 60s, not rejuvenated. His face was comfortably round with reddish cheeks, a skin with a slightly rugged texture, the trait of someone who used too much cellular reprofiling. His body was larger than average, but not unfit, not for someone his age.
I'm sorry. Do I know you?
Oh yes, Oscar, you know me. Oscar walked over to the sofa and looked closely, trying to fit the new face he saw into his own past.
I don't... Don't try and place me from memory. There's nothing left of what I used to look like.
I've been reprofiled 100 times over the decades, staying a couple of steps ahead of the law all this time. Oh, holy fuck.
The strength went out of Oscar's legs. He sat heavily at the other end of the sofa.
Adam. Adam, is that you?
None other.
Oh, God. It's been 40 years.
39. Oscar looked with real dread at the man who had once been his friend and comrade.
What do you want?
Is there any way to greet an old comrade?
Don't.
Don't what? Adam spat.
Don't remind you that you once were. Don't remind you that you used to have ideals. Principles. Don't remind you what you did for the cause.
I never fucking forgot, Oscar shouted.
Dear Christ, nobody could forget. Not that. Not what we did.
I'm glad to hear it.
Here I was, thinking you'd gone to work for the biggest corporation the human race has ever known, helping them spread their oppression and corruption to new worlds. 40 years. And you still haven't come up with a new goddamn speech. Do you have any idea how tired that crap is? And don't forget to use the word plutocrat. Big words like that always impress the poor ignorant saps you con into giving up their lives for your cause. It makes them think you're an intellectual, someone they can trust, someone who knows what they're doing.
It used to be your cause, Oscar. Have you given up on social justice? Is that the price of rejuvenation these days? Is that what the new young Oscar Monroe uses for currency?
Oh, spare me. I was only young once, and I was a fucking hothead buffoon, an easy target for bastards like Professor Graver to exploit. Damn it, we were just fucking kids. Just kids. We didn't know anything. You talk about being corrupted. You haven't got to look far to see where it really happens.
The party is right, and you know it. This society is not a just one.
Go on. Say it.
Oscar leaned forward, his fingers contracting into fists.
Go on, you miserable bastard. Say it. Say it for fuck's sake. Say, the ends justify the means. That's what you came here for, isn't it? That's what you wanted one last time.
Adam turned away from the fury in his eyes. Nothing justifies what we did, he said so quietly Oscar could barely hear it. We both know that. They sat at opposite ends of the sofa, not looking at each other. After a minute, Adam grunted dismissively.
How about this?
We're like an old married couple, always arguing.
What are you here for, Adam?
Come to bring me down in a blaze of glory? Oh, no. You don't get off that lightly.
Then what do you want?
His eyes narrowed as he took in his old friend.
Money? You must need rejuvenation pretty soon.
I'm not sure I care to carry on living in this universe.
Not even you are that stupid. You can't die.
That means you've wasted your whole life. It's a life lived true to myself and my principles.
Can you say that?
Yes.
I've helped find dozens of new worlds.
I've given our species a whole load of fresh starts. Phase 3 space isn't the same as 1 and 2. There's no revolution. Not one with Molotovs and people beating the shit out of each other on the street, but there's a difference.
Hmm.
Adam nodded, as if some question had been answered correctly. Same cause. Different angle of attack, huh?
Whatever. I'm not here to relive old battles with you. They've all been fought and lost by both of us. What the hell do you want, Adam?
I was sent to ask you something you won't like. It was the way he said it that finally alarmed Oscar. It was almost as if he was ashamed. Except Adam Alvin was never ashamed of what he did. Not ever. That was his whole problem. The reason for them turning their backs on each other all those decades ago. A truly venomous parting.
I doubt this day could get any worse.
Don't be so sure. I want you to review the second chance flight data.
Review the...
Oscar almost started choking.
Wait. You said sent. Who sent you? What do you mean, sent?
The man I work with on occasion believes there was an alien influence on board the Second Chance when you flew to the Dyson Pair. If the flight logs are given a professional analysis,
They may show the evidence he needs to prove this.
Oscar stared at the old man from his terrible past, his thoughts examining what had been said one word at a time.
Bradley Joe Hansen, he said at last. You work with Bradley Joe Hansen? You joined the Guardians of Selfhood? That bunch of nutters? Jesus fucking wept at him. Tell me you're joking. This is a sick joke. It has to be. It fucking has to be.
I have not joined the Guardians. I do know Joe Hansen. We have a mutually beneficial arrangement.
You?
Oscar pointed at him with a trembling finger.
Oh my God. You attacked the Second Chance. It was you.
Adam smiled with faint pride.
None other. You crazy, fucked up psychopath.
Oscar bunched up his fist, ready to pound, smash.
That terrorist attack nearly killed half of my friends. You ruined millions of dollars worth of equipment and facilities and delayed our launch date by months.
I know. I think I'm slipping. In the old days, I would have got the lot of you and blown up the starship.
You are crazy. People died, Adam.
They were all relifed, just like your friend, Dr. Bose.
I'm calling Navy Intelligence.
Ah, the universe's greatest oxymoron. How long do you think they'll give you in life suspension?
I don't care about myself, not anymore. You have to be stopped.
Oscar almost did it, almost told his e-butler to make the call. He was going to do it. He was really going to do it. Any second now.
No, Oscar, it's you and your Navy who are in the wrong now. You who are the danger to humanity.
Look where your precious Second Chance flight led us.
What is wrong with you? You don't believe that Guardian's crap. President Doi is an alien agent. Come on, not you.
He studied the old man's round face, hunting for some sign of guilt. What I believe doesn't matter, does it? Adam said.
It's what I want from you which is important.
We want the log data reviewed. And you're the perfect choice. You have unrestricted access, and it's your field of expertise.
Oh, now I get it. If I study the data and don't find your evidence, then someone makes a call to Raphael Columbia. Right?
No, Oscar. This is on the level. I want you to run a genuine, thorough search. It was only the alcohol flowing sweetly through his head that prevented Oscar from laughing outright.
Dear God. I never thought you'd be reduced to this. I mean, I always had this image of you carrying on the party's agenda. Every time one of those secession movements hit the Unisphere, I would think, I bet Adam's there, working away behind the scenes, urging the troops on, giving their leaders advice whether they want it or not. Then you'd slip back into the Commonwealth before CST closed the gateway and build up underground cell networks on every world. You'd have thousands of loyal activists ready for the day your word would come, and the whole Commonwealth would be plunged into civil war and revolution. That you'd be some kind of Gandhi or Mandela, or maybe just Napoleon, but certainly you'd be somebody. Not this, though. God, look at you. Just another fat, aging rebel who lost sight of his cause decades ago. So desperate you joined up with the saddest bunch of losers this universe has to offer. It's not real, Adam. There is no alien. I was on board that starship for over a year. I never bumped into it in the showers, never caught it stealing a late-night snack from the canteen. There was no ghost on Deck 13. This is where your conspiracy theory runs slap-bang into the solid wall of reality. You and Johansson can sit at home, pulling every rumor you want from the Unisphere and build them into a tower of your fact. It's all bullshit. There is no evidence to be found. So before you go, just leave the little crystal memory on the table, and I'll politely ignore it. Then when you're gone and I'm even more drunk, I'll access the file your friends have forged and decide if I'm going to splice it into the official log for you, so that I can save myself from life suspension because I'm too much of a pitiful coward to take responsibility for what I did once.
You need to get a shrink to take a good look at that self-loathing. It's not healthy.
Fuck you, Oscar said.
The pain he felt was close to physical now.
Just leave the memory crystal and go.
Adam struck him across the cheek.
The blow was almost powerful enough to knock him off the couch.
Shit!
Oscar dabbed at his mouth, blinking back tears from the stinging pain. A trickle of blood was oozing out from the corner of his lips. He gave Adam a wild look.
What the fuck is wrong with you? I said I'd do it. What more do you want?
There is no forged file, you motherfucker. This is as real as it gets. And I said there was an influence on board, not a bug-eyed monster. The Starflyer works through humans. Somebody on board the Second Chance turned the barrier off. Don't even try telling me that was coincidence. The same somebody who fixed it for Bose and Verbicky to be left behind.
You don't think it was remotely suspicious that of all the super-technological, multi-redundant, fail-soft gadgets you had on board, that a simple communicator failed at exactly that critical time?
Because I fucking do.
Somebody, Oscar asked cynically.
A crew member?
Yes, one of your precious crew.
One of your friends, or maybe more than one.
Who knows? But that's what you've got to find out.
That's even worse than an alien stowaway. Do you know how much training and back history investigation we went through to get on board? Nobody remotely suspect ever got close to the ship.
You mean like you and Dudley Bose?
Oscar stared at him for a long, chilling moment.
Look, Adam, what you're asking. It can't happen. Physically, it's not possible for me to do it. Do you realize how much raw data is in those logs?
I know. That's why we could never steal it and analyze it ourselves. You don't have to go through every byte yourself. You know the critical segments of the flight. That's where you look. Not at the main events. What happened on the bridge or in engineering, they'll be clean. It's what went on in the background that's important. Who was haunting Deck 13 when the barrier came down?
Find them. Not just for us. For yourself. For everyone. We need to know what really happened out there.
This is... I can't.
The alien is becoming more active now. You have to admit, there's some weird shit going down these days. That explosion on Venice Coast which took out our arms supplier? The murdered senator?
Bullshit. That was some covert operative from the government, or an intersolar dynasty. Everybody knows that.
Adam smiled maliciously.
Sounds like a conspiracy theory to me. You are so wrong. Why can you never admit that?
Then prove it. Exactly who are you betraying by looking at the data?
If we're wrong, you lose nothing. If, God forbid, we're right, we need to know. And you'll be a hero.
That's big enough to absolve all your past sins.
I don't need absolution.
Adam stood. You know I'm right. And I know you can never admit that to my face. So we'll stop macho posturing now, and I'll contact you every fortnight or so to check on your progress.
I won't do it.
Yeah. I said that very same thing when Johansson told me to get in touch with you. But it's not like either of us has a choice, is it? Not after Abaddon Station. Take care, Oscar. There's a lot of people depending on you.